Please come to council table.
May I please report, Mr. Frank Jones, and present argument for petition.
May it please the court, I'm Frank Jones with the law firm of Fulbright and Jaworski. I'm assisted in this appeal by Roger Townsend, who will make the rebuttal argument. We are counsel for Turner, Colley, and Braden, the engineers on a trunk sewer line, which is the subject matter of this lawsuit and which was never put in working order. The other parties are Brook Hollow, Houston, and two municipal utility districts who were the owner of the trunk sewer line, and Whitelack, Inc., the contractor who was hired to build the trunk sewer line. The lawsuit was initiated by Whitelack against Brook Hollow and the two municipal utility districts for additional costs incurred in connection with repairs that were attempted on the sewer line by Whitelack. Brook Hollow and the Muds filed a cross action against Whitelack seeking to recover additional costs incurred by Brook Hollow and the Muds in replacing the sewer line. Subsequently, Turner, Colley, and Braden was brought in as a third-party defendant by Brook Hollow and the Muds, seeking indemnity for the damages being claimed by Whitelack in the event of a recovery by Whitelack against the owners, and also seeking to recover for the cost that had been incurred by the owners in replacing the sewer line. I think that in order to put some of our points of error in perspective, it's necessary for me to give the court something of a recitation about how the sewer line was built and where it was built, and then the matters, the errors of which we are complaining, I think, become the significance becomes more apparent. Whitelack had been the contractor for a sewer line that was built on the south side of a bayou called Little White Oak Bayou. This exhibit right here, which is a reproduction of an exhibit to our brief in the Court of Civil Appeals, shows a profile of this trunk sewer. The thing is a little bit out of perspective because going this way, the horizontally, the spaces represent 100 feet. Going vertically, they represent one space represents 5 feet. The cross section here shows the trunk sewer, which was designed to run at a depth of about 22 feet down to a depth of about 26 feet. It's a gravity sewer line. And these vertical things that go up from the trunk sewer line to ground level are the manholes. It's quite like they built another trunk sewer on the south side of the bayou. The bayou runs right here. This is on the north side of the bayou, which came up perpendicular to the trunk sewer in question, crossed under the bayou, and connected right over here at this manhole. The significance of that is that the sand conditions for most of the way in which this other trunk sewer was built were the same as the sand conditions over here. In other words, below about 12 or 13 feet, they were below the water table. They had to use what are called well points to remove water from the sand. They shelled the banks down to a certain depth, and then they made a last cut to make a sort of square area in which the pipe was placed. The pipe was then bedded with wash shell, covered over with additional shell, backfilled, and then filled up to the ground level. The sewer line runs approximately 1,800 feet. The other line intersects here at the east end at the 22-foot end. Down here at this end, there is the west end, there's a lift station that takes the sewage up and over to a treatment plant. After the pipe had been laid and covered over, during a time that an inspection was being made to see if the sewer line complied with contract documents, it was discovered that there was some leakage in the sewer line, primarily in the areas up here at the east end. These initial breaks were repaired by the contractor. However, it seemed that as breaks would be repaired, other breaks would be discovered. This went on for a period of time until finally this part of the line, east of where we have these line breaks marked here, had been repaired. And in fact, at one point in time, a television camera was run through this part of the line, which is a little bit over half of the line. And it was determined by Turner, Colley, and Braden, based on this televised inspection of the line, that this portion of the line could be used. This part where we have all of these line breaks marked was a part where repairs were being made at the time a boundary dispute arose between the property owner, Brook Hollow, on whose land the sewer was being built, and an adjacent property owner to the north. This area was allowed to remain open for a period of several months, during which we say that Brook Hollow did not timely resolve boundary dispute. And we say that as a result of the failure to timely resolve that boundary dispute, this area deteriorated to such a condition that repairs which were attempted afterwards were never made, could not be made. Finally, the question came down to what should be done with the sewer line. Turner, Colley, and Braden recommended that this portion here, which is about 400 feet, be slip-lined. Slip-lining would involve actually putting a piece of plastic pipe inside the existing sewer pipe, grouting it, and making actually a sewer line which had a little bit restricted diameter, but which would utilize the existing pipe and allow the utilization of the existing sewer line. The owners consulted with another consulting engineering firm, the firm of Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan, and relying on recommendations made by Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan, decided to abandon this sewer line and built another sewer line which was above ground and used a lift station and force main. Those are the costs that they sought to recover in the lawsuit. This sewer line was constructed by a subcontractor of White Lake with the permission of the owners and the engineers, but with the understanding that White Lake would be responsible for supervision of the construction. It is the position of the engineers that the reason that the sewer line failed and the reason we had all these breaks is because of sloppy construction techniques on the part of the contractor. It is the contractor's position that the reason the sewer line failed is because the engineers refused to grant him permission during construction to use a timbered box type of construction, which is called Special Section 5, and which involves actually placing a wooden box down in the bottom of the trench and placing the wash shell and the pipe inside this wooden box. The cost of the slip lining, which was recommended by Turner, Colley, and Braden, was approximately $40,000 had the existing sewer line been used. The jury found that the failure of the sewer line to be in an operating condition was entirely the fault of the engineers, Turner, Colley, and Braden, and assessed damages in a total amount of $670,000. Part of that is indemnity for the costs incurred by the contractor in making repairs. Part of that is the owner's damages for the cost of the replacement line. The Court of Civil Appeals found that there was reversible error committed by the trial court in admitting a report that was prepared by this other consulting engineering firm, Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan, and also found that the trial court erred in the method of calculating the owner's damages. However, the Court of Civil Appeals reversed only a part of the judgment. That part which awarded the owners the damages for their costs in replacing the sewer line, but the Court of Civil Appeals left standing the award of indemnity for the contractor's damages. The only explanation that we have been able to come up with for this result, which we feel is strange, is that the Court of Civil Appeals made a statement in its opinion that no appeal was taken from the judgment in favor of White Lack, Inc. This statement is correct as it applies to the owners, but it is incorrect as it applies to Turner, Colley, and Braden, the third-party defendant. It is clear that Turner, Colley, and Braden appealed the entire judgment. The cost bond was made payable to the Harris County District Clerk, as is provided by the Rules of Civil Procedure, and we gave no notice of any intention to limit our appeal. So that White Lack, Inc., the contractor, is before this court just like the owners, just like Turner, Colley, and Braden. The owners take issue with this, but we have cited a number of authorities in our brief which we think make clear that all parties are before this court and that the Court of Civil Appeals had jurisdiction over White Lack, Inc., including a recent decision by the Austin Court of Civil Appeals in the Conan case, which is an NRA case, involving a plaintiff defendant third party defendant situation in which the defendant contended that the plaintiff was not before the court because the plaintiff had not been named in the appeal bond, and in which, as I recall,
The appeal bond was made payable to the district clerk just as we had done here. And the court pointed out in that case, just as I pointed out a few minutes ago, that there was no intention shown to limit the scope of the appeal, just as we had in this case. So I think it is clear that all parties are before this court, just as they were before the Court of Civil Appeals, and the court has jurisdiction over Whitelack, Inc. in this court, and the Court of Civil Appeals did. And the only explanation for the piecemeal result for reversing a part of the judgment is the Court of Civil Appeals' apparent misunderstanding as to where Whitelack, Inc. was at the time it considered the case. With regard to the Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan report that I mentioned a few minutes ago, this is a copy of the Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan report right here. This was described by the Court of Civil Appeals as a 40-page report which discussed almost every aspect of the construction, proposed repairs, estimated costs, and which should or should not, and what should or should not be done to correct the problems with the line. The court went on to say that the report also discussed slip lining and rejected that, even though it had been recommended by TC&B, and that the report encompassed many facets of the case which were an issue and on which TC&B was entitled to examine the authors of the report. The report was initially offered through the testimony of a man named Tom Martin, who was an official of the owners. We objected on the grounds that the report had not been properly authenticated by any representative of Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan, and on the grounds that the report was hearsay. The report was then offered for the limited purpose of showing Brook Hollow's state of mind, and it was received by the court for that limited purpose. We have found no case in Texas which has allowed a report containing opinions and conclusions of expert witnesses to be admitted into evidence under the so-called state of mind exception to the hearsay rule, absent some testimony from the expert witness which both authenticates the report and allows for cross-examination of his opinions and conclusions. As near as we can tell from the research that we've done, the purpose of the so-called state of mind exception to the hearsay rule, which is also referred to as circumstantial evidence, is to allow an explanation as to why a person did or did not do something. It's not offered for the truth of the matters asserted. In this case, where you have an expert opinion report with matters which are in controversy being discussed and opinions rendered by an expert, the only purpose of having such a report in evidence is to allow the jury to consider it for the truth of the matters asserted therein. And no instruction can limit the jury's consideration to the effect on the state of mind of the person who reviewed it. I think that the testimony of the witness, Tom Martin, that he relied on the expert report in deciding to abandon the trunk sewer is admissible. That shows his state of mind. But to go further and to allow the report to come into evidence and to allow, in effect, the Lockwood Andrews report to give testimony about slip lining and about their opinion that slip lining should not be used and that that was the most risky alternative to be considered, goes far beyond anything that has to do with state of mind, and in fact that is the only source of evidence that's contrary to TC&B's opinion that slip lining would be feasible to repair the line. The other expert that was called by the owners, a man named Wendell Beard, relied on Lockwood Andrews' report that recommended against slip lining in reaching his opinions. He did not render an independent opinion that slip lining should not have been used. I think it's clear that we were prejudiced by the admission of this report and by not having the opportunity to cross-examine Lockwood and Andrews, because absent the Lockwood Andrews report, the testimony from our people and our independent witnesses was that slip lining was feasible and that it could be done at a cost of $40,000, substantially less than the $670,000 we were eventually required to pay under the judgment. The next aspect that I want to talk about is the damages. The Court of Civil Appeals correctly recognized that the trial court did not submit the proper measure of damages and that my objection pointed this out to the court. The court submitted issues that inquired about the cost of the line that was used to replace this line. There was no finding First, as to whether or not this line could be repaired. Secondly, if it could be repaired, what the repair cost would be. If it couldn't be repaired, what the diminution in market value of the line was because of the problems they had had with it. However, in spite of the court submitting the erroneous measure of damages, the court then entered a judgment that wasn't even based on the jury's answers to the special issues. And the owners have gone through some controverted calculations in some of their briefs to try to explain how we get the damages that were actually entered, even though they're not encompassed by the jury's answers to the special issues. I think it is clear that reversal is required on this ground alone, and that reversal of the entire judgment is required because, as I understand the law in Texas, the courts cannot reverse for a new trial on the issue of damages alone. Therefore, solely on the way the damages were done, I think that the entire case is required to be reversed. The court granted writ of error on a point of error that we have about the wording of our factual insufficiency points. Our factual insufficiency points are phrased in terms of the trial court erred in entering judgment, rather than the trial court erred in failing to grant a motion for a new trial. The Court of Civil Appeals said that this was improper phraseology under this court's opinion in the chemical cleaning case, a 1970 Supreme Court decision, and the Court of Civil Appeals has followed this reasoning in several other cases to hold that the factual insufficiency points should be considered as no evidence points. We feel that the court's ruling is inconsistent with what this court has tried to do in recent years with regard to the amendments to the rules of civil procedure. It is our impression and our understanding that this court is trying to allow the parties to get their matters considered by the appellate courts in spite of procedural errors that the attorneys may make. And in fact, as I understand the rules now, there's only one absolute deadline that has to be met in the appellate process. To say that our factual insufficiency point should not be considered as a factual insufficiency point because we said the trial court erred in entering judgment rather than the trial court erred in failing to grant a motion for new trial, we feel is overly technical and improper in light of the way the court is now treating appellate matters and the rules of civil procedure. We would also point out that the appellate court does not have the power to cause the trial court to go back and grant the motion for new trial. The appellate court can only affect the judgment that was entered by the trial court, so that at least we feel that common sense would say that you ought to complain of the trial court's error in entering the judgment and not in failing to grant the motion for new trial. Because if the appellate court acts on the factual insufficiency point, it will reverse the judgment and will not reverse the court's order in failing to grant a motion for new trial. There are several other evidentiary points that we raised by way of point of error that were not, the points of error were not granted when the application for writ of error was granted. The court does have jurisdiction of them. I feel like, at least from the evidentiary jurisprudence of this state, they are worthy of consideration by this court, and I would like to briefly touch on them. The first one involves our attempted impeachment of the sole expert witness for the owners and the contractor, a man named Wendell Beard. We attempted to show, through cross-examination of Mr. Beard, and it was done by a bill of exception once the evidence was excluded, that he had been a member of a predecessor firm of Turner, Colley & Braden, and that his employment had been terminated because of unauthorized use of funds from his personal account. The court refused to allow us to bring that evidence before the jury. The Court of Civil Appeals felt that there was no question but that our inquiry was proper and that the subject matter of our inquiry was relevant. But it went on to say that since a period of about 25 years had elapsed since Mr. Beard had been with the predecessor of Turner, Colley & Braden, and since no one who had been with the firm at the time was still with the firm, that it wasn't that important. Well, this came as a big shock to Bob Colley, who is the Colley and Turner, Colley & Braden, and whom the evidence showed is now the chairman of the board, and whom Mr. Beard admitted was a junior partner of the firm at the time that Mr. Beard's employment was terminated. So that under the Court of Civil Appeals test, the evidence was relevant, and should have been admitted, and clearly it goes to motive or bias for giving testimony on the part of Mr. Beard, and something the jury should have been allowed to consider. The next matter had to do with a loan that was made to a man named Jack Farley, who had been a former employee of Turner, Colley & Braden. Mr. Farley was the only witness to the alleged conversation between Mr. Whitehead of Whitelack, Inc., and a man named Tom Owen with Turner, Colley & Braden, who is now deceased, regarding the request that the contractor says he made to use Special Section 5. Mr. Farley did not testify at the time of trial. However, we offered by way of bill of exception answers to interrogatories and correspondence that showed that within a week after Mr. Farley's deposition was scheduled and prior to the time it was taken, Mr. Whitehead made a $10,000 loan to Mr. Farley. The Court of Civil Appeals felt that this was relevant evidence to show an attempt or a possible attempt on the part of Whitelack to alter or affect the testimony of a witness, even though the witness didn't testify. But the court went on to say that they felt it was harmless error. I submit to you, when it goes to the credibility of a principal witness in the case, that it is more than just harmless error. I also submit that there's a cumulative effect of all of these things. We've got four or five different evidentiary matters that we're complaining about, and when you add these all up, it's clear that we were denied the opportunity to present significant evidence to the jury, and that did have an impact on the final outcome of the case. The final evidentiary matter has to do with some evidence that was excluded by the trial court as so-called settlement negotiations. We elicited, by way of bill of exceptions from several witnesses, testimony that a meeting at a time that repairs were being discussed, the owners, the representatives of the contractors made statements to the effect that this is a good line. And also testimony from representatives of the owner that this was the first time that they had ever heard Whitelack mention anything about the owner's, about the engineer's refusal to authorize the use of Special Section 5. Also at this same meeting, there was a discussion or an offer by the contractor to continue making repairs and to extend the guarantee period for the line in return for a payment of an additional $25,000. The Court of Civil Appeals said because there was the discussion about the $25,000, the trial court was right in finding that this was settlement negotiations. The Spiritus case, a Dallas NRE case, which is cited in the brief and other cases cited in the brief, clearly established that admissions against interest are admissible even when coupled with settlement negotiations. And I think that it's important to realize that these aren't even what would be considered settlement negotiations, because this meeting took place 16 months prior to the time that a lawsuit was initiated, and that under the extended guarantee, the contractor would still have liability for flaws in the line, even though he had received an additional amount of compensation. I think that it is clear that we are entitled to have a case reversed and remanded for a new trial. But more than that, I think that we are entitled to have the judgment rendered as a matter of law. There is no contention that the engineering firm, Turner, Colley & Braden, committed any error in the design of this line. The claim is that during construction of the line, we failed to authorize the use of this Special Section 5. Special Issue Number 1 inquires as to whose conduct, if any, measured by the instructions given in connection with the issue, approximately caused the sewer line, the failure of the sewer line to be in operating condition. The standard of care for the contractor was as follows. The contractor has a duty to construct the trunk sewer in substantial compliance with the plans and specifications unless it was prevented from doing so by the conduct of the owners and or the engineers, prevention being the key word. It was clear from the testimony of the contractor that while permission was refused, he could still have gone ahead and used Special Section 5 had he felt it was necessary. There was an $11 per foot unit price in the contract that had been agreed on in advance that the contractor was to be paid if Special Section 5 was used. The contract contained procedures whereby if the contractor felt that he was not being treated fairly, he could appeal the decision of the engineer to the owner. it is clear that he could have put in special section 5 at his own cost, assuming that the engineer did refuse to authorize its use, as is contended by the contractor, but as is disputed by the engineer, and then have sought reimbursement at a cost of $11 a foot for the cost of using special section 5, and that as a matter of law, he was not prevented from so doing either by the engineers or by the owners, and that therefore the engineers are entitled to a reversal and a rendition of the case in their favor. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you, Counsel. Is there further argument from petitioner?
Your Honor, Mr. Townsend is going to handle the rebuttal.
Your argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Cunningham will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Charles Cunningham. I'm with the firm of Johnson, Swanson & Barbie of Dallas, Texas. I represent Brook Hollow, Houston Incorporated, the two municipal utility districts who everybody's called the owners in the briefs, and I'll call the owners in this case. I apologize for my voice. I'm trying to recover from strep throat, so if it gives way, that'll be the reason.
Keep your distance, counsel. We enjoy it. You have our deepest sympathy.
The first issue I'd like to address, Your Honor, first of all, let me say that so the court can see graphically the parties in this lawsuit and the findings by the jury and how they relate to the findings by the jury in the actual Court of Civil Appeals, I prepared this chart. The purpose of the chart is to show that there were two lawsuits going on. On the top line is the contractor against the owners against the engineer. That's for the extra work the contractor sought. In addition to that, on the second line in red is the owners also sought the cost of a replacement line, the additional expenses that they had as a result of the failure of the trunk sewer. In red underneath that are the two points of error found by the Court of Civil Appeals, both of which relate solely to the second issue, and that is whether the owners had a right to independent damages from the engineer. Had nothing at all to do with the lawsuit that's depicted in black. First issue I'd like to address, which is probably the central issue before this court, is the Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan report. It's central both to the owner's point of error that the Court of Civil Appeals erred in stating that the trial court shouldn't have admitted it for a limited purpose, and Turner, Colleen Braden's point of error that admission of the report necessitated a new trial, not only for the independent damages claim to which the report related, but to the principal lawsuit for the extra work as well. The context of the admission of Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan report was this. Turner, Colleen Braden alleged that the owners failed to mitigate damages. They alleged that the owners were unreasonable in abandoning the trunk sewer. Mitigation of damages, at essence, is a question of reasonableness, whether the owners acted reasonably in abandoning the trunk sewer. To show that we acted reasonably, the owners, who by necessity had to rely on expert advice, they weren't experts, showed in support of their contention they acted reasonably that they acted on the considered judgment of another engineering firm. And in fact, the evidence was Turner, Colleen, Braden recommended to the owners that we hire an independent engineering firm to give us disinterested advice. So at trial, the representative from the owners testified that we abandoned the trunk sewer because we were told to do so by disinterested engineers. And to show that our reliance on the engineers were reasonable, we introduced the report to show that it was a comprehensive report, examined all the alternatives, and had an unequivocal conclusion that we should abandon the line. The report was offered and received into evidence for the limited purpose and only the purpose of showing the information on which the owners acted as bearing on the issue of the reasonableness of their conduct. The question before this court was the report hearsay? The Court of Civil Appeals says the report was hearsay. But as the court is aware, by definition, hearsay requires that the out-of-court declaration be offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. The Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan report was not offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. It was not hearsay. It was offered to show that the information on which the owners acted. For this purpose, it was wholly irrelevant whether the report was accurate or inaccurate. It made no difference to the purpose for which it was offered. If it was inaccurate or accurate, it still went to the questions of whether the owners acted reasonably. If the owners acted on reliance to the considered judgment of the independent expert, then they acted reasonably whether that advice turned out to be accurate or inaccurate. And it's a question of reasonableness, which goes to the question of mitigation of damages, not which was the best alternative to hindsight. There are few issues on which the law is any more uniform. Every case and every commentator agrees, and Turner, Colley, and Braden cannot cite one case to the contrary. As this court stated in the seminal decision of McAfee versus Travis Gas, where the question is whether a person acted reasonably, the information on which he acted, whether true or untrue, is original and material evidence and not hearsay. In a long and unbroken line of Texas cases following McAfee agree, as do Professors McCormick and Ray, who state unequivocally that a statement introduced to show the information the recipient had is bearing on the reasonableness of subsequent conduct is never hearsay. In this case, the report showed the information the owners had is bearing on the reasonableness of their subsequent conduct in abandoning the land. TC&B, again, cannot cite one case or commentary to the contrary. A holding that this report is hearsay would be directly at odds with every reported Texas case and every case that's been reported that I could find from any other jurisdiction. TC&B's only response is that the report may have also reflected on other questions. It may have also had to do something with the cause of the trunk sewer failure, and therefore the whole report should not have been admitted. Well, there are three independent reasons why that argument is untenable. First, the evidence, again, was offered for a limited purpose, and the trial court instructed the jury not to consider the report for any other purpose. This by itself forecloses any error or any argument that the whole report should have been excluded. Next, and which is perhaps more significant, TC&B waived this argument by not requesting exclusion of specified material in the report that was arguably prejudicial on the question of liability. As this court stated in Brown and Root versus Haydad, a general objection to documentary evidence is properly overruled if any part of the document is admissible and the objector fails to isolate portions objected to. TC&B failed to object to any isolated portions of the report that may have been irrelevant to the purpose for which the report was admitted, therefore it waived any argument on that score. Third, the report does not speak to liability. In the 40 pages of the report, it does not one time say what the cause of the trunk sewer failure is, not one single place. And therefore, the admission of the report, which was proper, had nothing at all to do with the claim or the issue of whether or not Turner, Colley, and Braden was solely at fault for the trunk sewer failure. Because the report was admissible, the Court of Civil Appeals erred in sustaining Turner, Colley, and Braden's point of error. In addition, the admissibility of the report forecloses TC&B's contention in its application that the whole case, not just the indemnity portion, should be reversed because of the report's admission. The next issue, unless the court has questions right now on that subject, I'd like to address is this question of damages, the proper measure of damages, which is the second error found by the Court of Civil Appeals. Note again that this question, like the question of Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan report, goes only to the independent damages portion of the lawsuit and not to the indemnity claim. And indeed, it goes, like the Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan report, only to the damages aspect of the independent claim. The context of the measure of damages issues was this. The trial court failed to enter judgment in accordance with the measure of damages submitted to and found by the jury, and instead awarded the owners damages based upon another measure of damages, which gave the owners a larger recovery. The question before this court on which it granted application is whether the measure of damages submitted to the jury was proper, because if it was proper, even if the Court of Civil Appeals was correct that the trial court should not have applied its own measure of damages, then the Court of Civil Appeals should have reversed but rendered judgment in accordance with the jury verdict if what was submitted to the jury was proper in the first instance. Now, what the jury was asked to do by the trial court was to determine the reasonable and necessary cost of repairing the line by replacing the defective portions. The facts were these. The defective portion of the line cost approximately $250,000. The shallower, less costly replacement was found by the jury to cost approximately $195,000. But this replacement used approximately $8,000 worth of the original line and has additional energy costs, the present value of which were found by the jury to be roughly $18,000. So all in all, the replacement turned out to be a sum $29,000 cheaper than the original construction, and that's what the jury awarded. Now, it's significant to keep that in mind. The replacement cost found by the jury was cheaper than the construction of the portion of the line that had to be abandoned. It was substantially less costly, and that's directly at odds with what Turner, Colley, and Braden says in its brief, and that was a mistake made by the Court of Civil Appeals in its rendition of the facts. The replacement was cheaper, not more costly than the original construction. The question then, were the reasonable and necessary costs incurred in replacing this portion of the line a proper measure of damages? Without question, we believe that it is. In fact, there are dozens of Texas cases cited in our supplemental brief, or approximately a dozen, which have held that in cases of this nature, reasonable replacement and repair costs properly measure damages, a fact recognized by this court in its Nobility Homes opinion involving the replacement and repair costs for defectively constructed mobile home. Cases allowing recovery of replacement and repair costs that include such things as storage tanks, air conditioning panels, houses, a tractor, and in the case of Frontier Feedlots versus Conklin, a defective drainage system, very similar to a sewage system. As Professor McCormick in his damages treatise states, quote, the damages awarded to the owner for defective construction are measured, A, if the defect is remediable without undue loss or expense by the cost of repair or replacement. Both restatements agree with Professor McCormick's announcement and this court's pronouncement in the Nobility Homes case. There is no question under the law that the replacement costs found by the jury properly assess the owner's damages. And this is not to say that repair and replacement costs are the only proper measure. They can be measured, as PC&B has argued, by the difference in value of the sewer as warranted and as delivered. However, it is well settled in Texas that the choice between these two measures of damages is, in the first instance, for the plaintiff. As this court stated in Pasadena State Bank versus Isaac, as the Courts of Civil Appeals recognized last year in Green versus Bearden Enterprises, the plaintiff need only prove the reasonable repair and replacement costs, and the defendant, if he's dissatisfied with this measure of damages, has the burden to prove and secure jury findings that the value of the property was enhanced by the work or that the replacement was economically wasted. TC&B, however, never sought to prove that the value of the line was enhanced by the replacement because, in fact, the replacement was a cheaper alternative than the original construction. It was shallower. And TC&B never requested a jury instruction that the replacement was to see if the replacement was economically wasteful. Consequently, TC&B cannot now claim that the owners are not entitled to the reasonable replacement cost of land, and this court should reverse the Court of Civil Appeals and render judgment in accordance with the jury verdict on damages. The remaining one of two issues that the court wished to hear argument on were whether or not Turner, Colley, and Braden properly raised legal sufficiency points of error. Now, Turner, Colley, and Braden stated the evidence points of error complained to the trial court's entry of judgment on the basis of the evidence. Turner, Colley, and Braden is contending that even though it complained of entry of judgment, that it nevertheless raised factual sufficiency points of error. Now, the background of this question is this. Under Texas procedure, a trial court must enter judgment if the evidence is legally sufficient. It cannot refuse to enter judgment if the evidence is factually insufficient. It can, of course, grant a new trial. Consequently, this court announced in Chemical Cleaning flatly that a point of error stating that the trial court erred in rendering judgment because the state of the evidence is only a no evidence point, stated that very unequivocally. Attorney Colin Braden nevertheless contends it raised factual sufficiency points of error because the 1978 rule changes abolishing in most respects requirement of filing a motion for a new trial makes it proper to complain on appeal that the trial court erred in entering judgment if you want to raise factual sufficiency points as opposed to failing to grant a new trial. Well, this ignores the problem, and there are two insurmountable bars to this argument. First, at least seven decisions by the Court of Civil Appeals after the 1978 rules changes that we cited in our brief have adhered to chemical cleaning and ruled that a point of error framed that the trial court erred in entering judgment raises only a no evidence point. The reason for these decisions after the rule change and the logic is that chemical cleaning, the logic behind chemical cleaning, is still valid. The trial court still cannot refuse to enter judgment if the evidence is legally...
What did they argue under the point? What did they pray for? That's what we used to look at, those things. Look at the whole point, don't you? What did they argue?
They argued alternatively that the case should be reversed and rendered, or that a new trial be granted.
Did they argue the evidence that it's insufficient, or did they say it's no evidence, or what did they say?
They argued alternatively in the body of the point, no evidence or insufficient evidence. And in fact, in the points of error, the ones that are at issue, they state that the trial court erred in entering judgment on the basis of insufficient evidence. So they do present the question of insufficient evidence. The problem is that exact phraseology of the point of error was passed on by this court in its chemical cleaning decision.
Well, I tell you, we had hundreds of them on the San Antonio court that were phrased incorrectly, but if you could tell what they were shooting at, I thought 25 years ago we started looking and would meet whatever they were arguing.
Your Honor, not one case that I could find by this court or by any court of civil appeals has addressed the question and resolved it favorably to Turner, Colleen, Brady that a point of error framed that the trial court erred in rendering judgment raises a factual sufficiency point even if the body of the point of error attempts to do that, even if the argument...
Well, counsel, there are cases which say that a point can be broadened or clarified by looking at the argument under the point. That shows the court. We're not playing games. We're trying to decide lawsuits. And that shows what the argument between the parties is. Now, there are a number of cases that say that you can look at the argument under the point and find out what the point is.
Yes, sir. If I would say, Your Honor, it does not contradict or does not suggest something that the point of error states flatly to the contrary. In this case, the point of error states the court erred in entering judgment. And that is the question.
That's a pure law thing. You're right on that.
And that is what the court directly addressed in its chemical cleaning opinion in an unbroken line of course of civil appeals is appeal even after the 1978 rule changes. And to say that the point of error framed by Turner, Colleen, Braden raised factual sufficiency points, even though it attempted to in the body of the point of error, will run directly at odds with the very clear language of this court and of every court of civil appeals that's addressed the question. These courts of civil appeals have recognized the 1978 rule changes don't do away with this requirement that the point of error be not framed in terms that the trial court erred in rendering judgment. And the reason for that is that even after the rule changes, the trial court must enter judgment if the evidence is legally sufficient. So the proper complaint on appeal is that the case simply should be reversed because of factual insufficiency of the evidence, not that the trial court erred in entering judgment. The trial court had no choice but to enter judgment. But even if the rule changes did have some effect on that question, it won't have any effect in Turner and Colleen Braden's case because Turner and Colleen Braden filed a motion for a new trial in this case. And so its complaint on appeal was that the trial court erred in failing to grant a new trial. And under chemical cleaning and its unbroken line of cases, those points of error only raised legal sufficiency point. And to admit, be truthful with the court, we did the same thing. And our framed it in that the trial court erred in entering judgment. And the trial court correctly, in our opinion, and if the Court of Civil Appeals correctly, in our opinion, overruled those points of errors on the basis that the points of errors weren't properly framed. The final issue that the Court asked to hear argument on was this issue of whether there ought to be a complete reversal of the case. Now, Turner, Cohen, Braden says White lacking somehow before this Court. We object strenuously to that. First of all, not one single point of error to the Court of Civil Appeals filed by Turner, Colleen, Braden in any way called into question the judgment of the contractor against the owner. Not one other point of error. So White Lack is not before this Court. In many ways, we wish that White Lack were before this Court, but White Lack is not before this Court. Nobody filed a point of error attacking the validity of the judgment of the contractor against the owners. Because Turner, Colleen, Braden did not attack the validity of the judgment of the contractor against the owners, Rule 38A is directly applicable. Rule 38A states that Turner, Colleen, Braden, the third-party defendant, is bound by the adjudication between the contractor and the owner. Turner, Colleen, Braden is bound by that adjudication. Because it's bound by that adjudication, it could have appealed in the Court of Civil Appeals on behalf of the owner. If it's bound by it, of course it could have appealed. And there's authority to that effect. But it did not appeal the underlying judgment of the contractors of the owners. Therefore, it's bound by that adjudication, and it can't now obtain a reversal of that adjudication on the basis that the claims are inextricably linked. They are not inextricably linked. In fact, if this Court upholds the Court of Civil Appeals and reverses on the two grounds, or upholds a reversal on the two grounds cited by the Court of Appeals, this case right here will go down for mid-trial, the independent damages claim. But on the new trial, the question of liability, the question of who was solely at fault for the failure of the trunk sewer, will not be open to relitigation. The reason it won't be open to relitigation is because the collateral estoppel will be an independent, severed, final judgment. This judgment right here saying that the engineers are 100% at fault for the failure of the trunk sewer. As a result, even though the case goes down for a completely new trial, the rule of decision for the trial court, of course, the liability has already been decided. And on the doctrine of collateral estoppel, the issue of the engineer's liability is to be determined, and the only question open for relitigation would be the damages that the owner sustained, the independent damages, which is the error, which is the question that both points of error related to. So the main reason, however, we think the whole case should not be reversed, of course, is we think there is no question that the Lockwood, Andrews, and Noonan report was properly admitted by the trial court, and secondarily, that the measure of damages submitted to the jury and found by the jury was proper, so the trial court should have rendered judgment in accordance with that jury verdict. Because the two errors found by the Court of Civil Appeals, we think, were erroneous in the case, should not be reversed at all, much less be reversed in toto. Now, to rule otherwise, and to rule that the whole case should be remanded for trial, everything, would be grossly unfair both to the owners and the contractors. It would be grossly unfair to the owners because, as I said, Rule 38A made Turner, Colleen, and Braden bound by the adjudication between the owners and the contractors. Turner, Colleen, and Braden chose not to appeal that adjudication. Therefore, the owners have paid off White Light. Now, in this court, are waiting to be reimbursed. Now, Turner, Colleen, and Braden have come in asking that the principal decision, the contract against the owners, be overturned, even though it was they that chose not to appeal that adjudication. We think that that would be grossly unfair. Second, it would be grossly unfair to the contractor, because Turner, Colleen, Braden could have brought the contractor in for this appeal, could have claimed his point of error that the attacking the validity of the underlying judgment of the contract against the owners and given White Lack the right and ability to participate in this appeal and protect its interests. It chose not to do so. In sum, then, if the independent damages claim is reversed, which the owners believe would be impossible, then the collateral estoppel is going to foreclose any new examination of liability. Because of that, there is no reason to reverse this whole case, even if the Court of Civil Appeals is affirmed by this court. Thank you, Nathan. All right. Here, rebuttal argument from your side.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I want to respond to some of the last matters that Burkhalo's just raised. They say that we didn't attack the contractor's judgment in the Court of Appeals. If I may, let me read you our first point of error in the Court of Appeals. The trial court erred in entering judgment against TC&B because the contractor failed to complete construction. We have point of error 7 and 8, which I won't bother to read because they're lengthy, but they're complaining of the sufficiency, both legally and factually, of the evidence supporting the jury's answer that the contractor was not at fault. So the contention that we did not raise the contractor before the Court of Appeals is totally false. We copied the contractor with all documents that had been filed. This is not a matter of record, but the contractor sat in the audience and watched the oral argument at the Court of Appeals. I think under this court's NRE in the Conan construction case, which we cite in our brief, the fact that we did not file the notice of limitation of appeal, there's no doubt that the entire judgment goes up on appeal. In Texas, there is one final judgment. We did everything we could to get all the parties before the court. I want to mention briefly the Lockwood Andrews and Newnham report. Burkhalo claims that we did not obliterate or blot out the objectionable parts of that report. There is a case that we did not cite in our brief because we did not anticipate this argument coming. There's a case by the Supreme Court of Texas, 1978, Hurtado versus Texas Employers Insurance. In Hurtado, this court held that the burden to obliterate objectionable materials in a record is on the offering party. The objecting party must only point out his objection, make it known to the trial court. The burden then goes on the offering party to remove the objectionable materials.
What was your objection to the report?
We had three objections, Your Honor. The first one was that it was unauthenticated by anyone from Lockwood, Andrews, and Newman just coming in and saying, this is our report, this is my signature. As it was, Mr. Martin just said, this is what Lockwood, Andrews, and Newnham gave me. He didn't say, I recognize the signature, I recognize the logo, or anything. That was number one. At the same time, we said, Your Honor, this is hearsay because it has other matters in it. Specifically, we have Special Section 5 being mentioned. They would tell the court that it's only relevant to mitigation. I would point out to the court there was no instruction given the jury about mitigation of damages. Under Special Issue Number 1, which said whose conduct, if any, proximately caused the failure of the sewer line to be an operating condition, we were taking the position that the owners, by abandoning a line that could have been repaired by slip lining, were proximately the cause of the failure of the sewer line to be an operating condition. The third objection, Your Honor, was that it was a loafer violation. It had opinions that we had not had an opportunity to cross-examine upon. The trial court overruled our objection and admitted the report. This is significant because this followed an exchange where Mr. Martin, the Burkhalo representative, had testified, yes, I relied on Lockwood, Andrews, and Newnham. They told me to abandon the line. I agree with Mr. Jones that this would be admissible to show his state of mind, but I think when you go one step further and get a 40-page engineering report in front of the jury, you have a serious problem. In Hurtado, this court said that any time the issue is on causation with records, you have to have the opportunity to cross-examine.
Assuming the objection was just that it was hearsay, sustained or overruled, would you not have some kind of a burden to keep out other parts that you particularly objected to?
I don't believe so in this instance, Your Honor, because the trial judge was made aware of our objection, the fact that there were objectionable portions. That is all the court required in Hurtado, and specifically the court noted the Brown and Root case that Burkhalo relies on to say that a general objection is no good. And the court seemed to adopt the view of the dissenting judge and said, quote, that the attention of the trial court has been specifically called to the inadmissible nature of the records, then there's no burden on the objectioning party to go any further. So I think that you have a duty to make a specific objection that there is hearsay or that there is opinion testimony. So I don't think there's a specific burden to go through page by page, line by line, to point that out.
Well, there's a general rule that if some part of the document is admissible and there's a broad objection, anything the trial judge does is not error.
Yes, sir, as a general rule, but I don't think that's applicable here. We had the hearsay objection. We had.
Well, in your objection to this, did you say this part's objectionable or this subject is objectionable, or was it just the objection, this is hearsay testimony?
We were in between those positions, Your Honor. We said this is hearsay because it introduces other matters other than their state of mind. But we did not go through and say, Judge, on page one, it says such and such. On page two, it says such and such. So we were somewhere in between simply saying it's hearsay or simply saying, you know, each particular item. But I would point out to the court, even if you don't agree with the hearsay objection, the authentication objection should be valid. Think of the situation we have here where a party can come into court, pull out any sort of document and say, yes, this is what so-and-so gave me and I relied on it, and in it goes to the jury with no authentication whatsoever.
Would it be a question whether he was reasonable in relying on something just handed to him?
Your Honor, there is no proof really that it was handed to him by Lockwood Andrews.
Or mailed to him? I don't know how he got it.
For his state of mind, I'm not sure that it would be relevant, because in this report you're talking about the opinions of someone else. I can see a distinction where it's reasonable to rely on a fact that someone gives you that you could go verify for yourself. Before there's an opinion that involves expertise, I'm not sure that it is probative of reasonableness. I think you have to have the expert who prepared those opinions come in so you can cross-examine him and so the jury can decide if they were reasonable in relying on that opinion. And that's the problem we had in this case. But the report itself was involved with causation and liability. It was not limited to just damages like they are saying.
You had a case a few minutes ago that you said was not in your brief.
Yes, sir.
And can you give us the cite on that?
Yes, sir. That is Hurtado, H-U-R-T-A-D-O versus T-E-I-A, 574 Southwest 2nd, 536. As far as the factual sufficiency points of evidence go, I will simply say that there seems to be some confusion in the course as to what is an adequate point. The owners admitted that they did the same thing below, and whatever the court decides on that point, it ought to be cleared up for people. The court does not have to reach that issue because that would be a remand to the Court of Appeals and at most a new trial if this court decides that there's reversible error in another part of the judgment. But we are not simply seeking a remand. We're seeking a rendition because this involves standard form contracts that are being used throughout the nation between architects, engineers, owners, and contractors. And we think under the contractual language as a matter of law, the contractor had no right to get a recovery in this case. Special issue number one defined the duty of the contractor as to obey the plans and specs unless he was prevented. His testimony, which we cited in the brief, he admits that he was not prevented, that he could have put it in at his own expense. Brook Hollow has said in their brief that there was criticism of TCMB's design. This is not true. Their own expert, Mr. Beard, who you've heard us talk about on the impeachment question, Mr. Beard is an engineer. He said that he would have designed the project just like we did. The effect of all this is that Turner Colley and Braden has been blamed for the failure of the sewer line because during construction, the contractor didn't go out and use Special Section 5. But the contract documents say the engineer designs the project. The engineer does not have construction responsibility. That's the duty the contractor assumes when he signs the piece of paper. The engineer had a construction job. We were hired to observe and report to the owner. But nothing in that one activity made us the insurer that the contractor's going to build the line right. He assumed that duty, And based on this court's decision, albeit in 1907, in the Lonergan case, which we cite in our brief, the contractor has to build that line or he can't recover. Lonergan is stronger than our case because in Lonergan, the architect's plans were no good. Everybody admitted it. And the court still held the contractor assumed that risk when he signed the contract to build. In our case, the testimony is that the plans were good. Thank you very much.
Counsel, rebuttal, rebuttal, Alderman.
Thank you. Turner, Cullen, and Braden said, referred to its points of error, saying that it brought white light before the court. If you look at those points of error, each one states that the court, the trial court erred in entering judgment against TC&B. It did not mention any error in the rendition of the judgment in favor of the contractors and against the owners. White Lack, on the basis of the points of error, had no reason to respond to this appeal. TC&B's complaint was it had a judgment against it. TC&B attacked, if it wanted to attack the validity of the underlying judgment of the contract against the owners, it chose the wrong end to do that. It could not attack it at this point because Rule 38A is bound by this determination. So what Turner, Colleen, Braden had to do, it wanted to bring the contract up here, is attack this judgment. The owners didn't have to do anything. They can sit back because they brought Turner, Colleen, Braden in, protected by Rule 38A, saying that if we lose, then the engineer is going to be bound by this determination. So it did not bring White Light back in any of its points of error. Moreover, its appeal bond states that it is appealing the judgment of the owners against the engineers. It states that in black and white in its appeal bond. It in no way puts White Lock on notice that what's being attacked is the judgment of the contractor against the owners. Now, I think Mr. Townsend is playing a little loose with the record when he states that in objecting to Lockwood Andrews and Minner report, it started talking about the report going into questions of liability. Mr. Jones's objection doesn't say that. And I advise the court to look at the record on that point, the transcript on that point. It states that the report is hearsay, it has an authentication objection, it has a Lopez versus Andrew objection. It doesn't say that it goes into other matters that need to be excluded. It no way puts the trial court on notice of that fact. This court has recognized, of course, civil appeal has recognized that if a document is offered, it's admissible, and you want something excluded, you ask that it be excluded. You just don't make a general objection saying it goes into other matters and then have the trial judge vested with responsibility in the offering party to guess what's in opposing counsel's mind and go through and obliterate everything that may be prejudicial to the opposition. Finally, there is no way that the admission of the Lockwood Andrews and Newham report, which went to the question of reasonable for the owner's abandonment of the trunk sewer, was dependent on the validity of the report. Because it wasn't dependent on the validity of the report, there's no reason why Turner, Colleen, Braden should have had an opportunity to cross-examine the authors of that report. And the reason is this. To give an example, if the question is it reasonable for me to go to the hospital, I can show that I went to the hospital on the advice of a doctor. That goes to the question of reasonableness. Was it reasonable for me to rely on that advice? The question is not at all, was that advice good? Was it sound medical judgment? But the inquiry would be more like, how did you pick the doctor? What was the form of his advice? Did it appear to be considered advice when he gave it to you? Not was the advice valid. Secondarily, the report was authenticated. The Brook Hollow representative who testified said, this is a Lockwood Andrews and Newman report that we commissioned to tell us what to do with respect to the trunk sewer. We relied on this report, which tells us to abandon the trunk sewer after it spends 40 pages analyzing the alternative. We don't know what to do except to rely on an expert. So all the authentication that was ever necessary was offered. Not to take up any more of the court's time because my voice was given away a long time ago. I thank you for the honor of being here.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments of both parties. The court will take a brief recess.
William, please rise.